It's the NPR News Update for Wednesday, August 27. I'm Phil Picardi. Today on the podcast, several stories in depth. We hear about the Minnesota man who may have died fighting with ISIS. We hear about the vote to unionize personal care assistants, cops using body cameras in Minneapolis, a new look U of M campus, what happens to the trash at the state fair, and what happens to the money pledged during an ice bucket challenge. First, a 33-year-old Minnesota resident has died in Syria. U.S. officials confirmed that yesterday. A report from NBC News says the man was fighting for the Islamic State, known as ISIS. Peter Cox reports friends are trying to understand what happened to the man they knew here in the Twin Cities.
The National Security Council said U.S. citizen Douglas McCain died in Syria. NBC News reported yesterday McCain was killed over the weekend while fighting for ISIS. They attributed the information to the Free Syrian Army and said photos of his passport and body were seen by NBC News. McCain grew up in Minneapolis and New Hope. According to Robbinsdale area schools, he attended Robbinsdale Cooper High School from 1997 to 1999. Then transferred to Robbinsdale Armstrong High School, which he attended from January to June of 2000. A spokesperson for the district says there's no record he graduated. According to Minnesota court records, McCain had a few encounters with police, mostly in the early 2000s, for driving offenses, disorderly conduct, and a minor drug possession charge. Most recently, he'd been living in San Diego. An acquaintance says he'd seen McCain in San Diego in March. Speaking from his apartment in New Hope, Isaac Chase, now 28, remembers meeting McCain after moving from St. Paul. He was 11 at the time and didn't know anyone. One day he was in the park near the complex and saw a group of bigger kids playing basketball.
Doug was the first one to pretty much, you know, ask me if I wanted to play basketball with him. So I started playing, and ever since then we've been cool and hanging out. We always play basketball from pretty much sun up to sundown.
Chase said McCain was funny and outgoing, a people person who advised him to do the right things. The last time Chase saw McCain was in 2008. He heard the news reports of McCain's death in Syria yesterday.
Yes, it surprised me a lot. Just knowing of him, he was a good person, so it really does.
Posts in McCain's Twitter feed say he converted to Islam 10 years ago. Friends and family posted condolences on McCain's Facebook page after initial reports of his death. The page has since been deleted. McCain appears to have known Abdirahman Muhammad, a Minneapolis man who went to Syria and joined the Islamic State. On January 2nd, Muhammad shocked his Facebook friends after he posted a photo of himself holding a rifle in one hand and the Quran in the other, with the caption that translates to Syria. However, McCain seemed to encourage Muhammad to fight. "Brother, don't listen to these people," McCain told Muhammad in a Facebook exchange on February 19th. "They wish they had your heart. Continue protecting our brothers and sisters." In a statement yesterday, a National Security Council spokesperson said, quote, "We continue to use every tool we possess to disrupt and dissuade individuals from traveling abroad for violent jihad, and to track and engage those who return." With reporting from Mukhtar Ibrahim, I'm Peter Cox for Minnesota Public Radio News.
Government-subsidized personal care assistants who work with the elderly and disabled in their homes have voted to form a union. State officials counted the ballots yesterday in what ended up being a low-participation election. Here's Tim Pugmire.
Labor organizers billed it as the largest union vote in Minnesota history. But only 22% of the nearly 27,000 eligible home health workers mailed in their ballots this month. The final tally was about 3,500 yes and about 2,300 no. Still, union supporters were celebrating the outcome. Deborah Housie, a PCA from Minneapolis, said she wasn't concerned by the numbers.
Yes, it doesn't matter. The vote is in. We now have a union. We are now not invisible anymore. We are a force to be reckoned with. We are 26,000 plus strong.
The vote means that the Service Employees International Union will now represent PCAs at the bargaining table in negotiations with the state. Working conditions vary widely for PCAs, and turnover can be high among those caring for non-family members. But a U.S. Supreme Court ruling earlier this summer said similar workers in Indiana could not be compelled to pay fair share union dues if they object. Summer Spica, a PCA and union supporter from St. Paul, downplayed the financial impact of that ruling on the new union.
I mean, again, it comes back to 60% of the people voted that they want a union, and with that, that's the majority, and we will move forward with that support and continue to change lives for ourselves and our clients.
The election was made possible by a law Governor Mark Dayton and the DFL-controlled legislature enacted in 2013. Democrats backed the measure while Republicans opposed it. GOP State Representative Tara Mack of Apple Valley said she was disappointed that such a big shift in policy was decided by so few PCAs.
If they were a bit confused and not totally sure exactly what was going on and the repercussions, I just am fearful that there's not a real firm grasp on what this means for folks. And I think, you know, we have to keep in mind a lot of the people affected, they day in and day out are, you know, up to their eyeballs in what it takes to care for their loved ones or disabled folks.
Union opponents went to court to try to stop the election, but a federal judge denied their motion for a temporary injunction last week, calling the challenge premature. But now that the election results are known, opponents plan to push ahead with a suit that claims the law allowing the vote is unconstitutional. The National Right to Work Foundation is providing legal help to a group of PCAs who brought that lawsuit. Mark Mix, the foundation's president, said in a statement that providers' First Amendment right to free association should not be put to any vote. He described the election result as the tyranny of a small minority. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News.
There's a growing nationwide discussion about the use of body cameras for cops after an officer in Ferguson, Missouri, shot and killed an unarmed teenager 2 weeks ago. In Minnesota, several police departments are using the cameras, and others are planning for them. But before cops start recording encounters with citizens and suspects, police and city officials first need to consider how and when the cameras will be used. Brant Williams reports from Minneapolis.
Drop that knife. Drop that. Put that down. Put it down!
A Burnsville police officer draws his gun on a man carrying a box cutter in the lobby of the city's police headquarters. The encounter was captured on video by a camera worn on the officer's chest. The officer keeps his gun aimed at the man and calls for backup.
Sir, you're going to need to drop that. Drop the knife.
The grainy video shows another officer using a taser-like device, which stuns the man, causing him to fall to the ground. Burnsville Police Chief Eric Giesecke says his department was the first in the state to issue cameras to its officers in 2010. He says officers are required to turn on the cameras whenever they perform traffic stops and engage in other potentially volatile situations.
If they're involved with a confrontational citizen, use of force situations, obviously we want to activate it. And to record statements by the subjects, victims, and witnesses. And it's a good tool when you're advising an individual of their Miranda rights.
Giesecke says officers are not required to tell people they're being recorded. Officers cannot edit the footage. And he says the department treats video like any other police document subject to government data practices law. He says the length of time video is stored depends on the type of case. Proponents of the use of body cameras say when encounters between police and the public are videotaped, both parties tend to be on their best behavior. Data recently collected by the Rialto, California Police Department support that claim. After Rialto officers began wearing the cameras, the department saw an 88% drop in complaints against officers and a 60% drop in the use of force by officers over a year's time.
I think where we have to be very careful is to think that this is the be-all, end-all.
Howard Wasserman is a law professor at Florida International University. He says the technology is very promising, but he says the cameras haven't been in use long enough to show they directly reduce complaints against officers and uses of force by officers.
I think what everybody's hoping is that it is going to have both an evidentiary benefit and a deterrence benefit for everybody.
Burnsville Police Chief Eric Giesecke says he doesn't have statistics to show the cameras have reduced officer complaints and incidents of use of force. But he says sometimes people drop complaints against officers after they've seen video of their encounters. Other cities are following Burnsville's lead. Spring Lake Park Police Chief Doug Ebeltoft says his department is in the process of replacing the squad car cameras with wearable cameras for officers. Ibeltoff says he wants the body cameras to activate automatically when the squad car lights are turned on.
That way then the officer will not have to manually turn the system on or off, and that it automatically starts when the light bar is activated for a traffic stop or responding to some type of call, whether it be a disturbance, a medical. And then when the officer gets to the location and exits the vehicle, the system is still running.
The Duluth Police Department also began using the cameras this year. Rochester and Minneapolis are still in the planning stages. A spokesman for the St. Paul Police Department says the capital city is watching how other cities use the cameras and will likely adopt the technology sometime in the future. Minneapolis Mayor Betsy Hodges is proposing to spend more than $1 million next year for the police department to start equipping officers with the cameras. A pilot program involving 36 officers is planned for this fall. Brant Williams, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
This week, University of Minnesota freshmen are arriving at the school. That's a little different from the campus of last year. Physical changes include light rail trains now cutting through the campus. Also, pro football fans will converge on at least 8 Vikings games this fall and winter on the campus. And the U has become more safety conscious in the wake of last fall's spike in crime, which saw autumn robberies rise 50%. Higher ed reporter Alex Friedrich talked about it with Stephen John.
Let's start with the security issue. What's different this year?
Well, the U has put in key card systems in buildings and cut back public access hours at something like 140 of them. Students do have extended access with their ID cards, but buildings generally won't be as free and open as they used to be. And the campus has more security cameras, better lighting between residence halls and in some high traffic areas.
Any other safety initiatives?
Well, students will see more late night bus and safety escort service than they did a year ago. The student body president told me the U is also really pounding home the safety message with families. Students will also have Sunday Vikings games this year at TCF Bank Stadium. And this year's class is the first incoming class to have a light rail system. I guess through all of this, they should encounter, you know, more campus police and other public safety personnel, especially in Vikings game days.
How will those Sunday Vikings games affect campus life besides the obvious increased number of visitors?
Well, things will definitely be hopping on those days and a lot more activity and traffic around the stadium. One parent told me she warned her daughter that Vikings fans may be different from Gophers fans and that they drink more and could be, you know, rowdier. Campus safety officials tell me they'll keep an eye on things, but they don't expect that much of a difference between Gopher fans and Vikings fans. Students may have to deal with more crowds and traffic, but I'm told the changes and inconveniences shouldn't be too big.
And how concerned are they about the new light rail system?
Some parents have been asking the U whether it will increase crime by bringing in criminals who want to target students. That's still a question mark, but the chief of campus police has doubts about that happening. He'll have his eye on it, but for now it seems like university leaders are more concerned about potential accidents.
You mean involving pedestrians?
Right. I mean, for example, they've been seeing some students walking around wearing headphones and not really paying attention to train crossings. So police from the U and Metro Transit will be teaching them about train safety and how not to be targets for crime.
Has last year's crime spike registered much with the students and their parents this year?
I think it may be more of a concern for returning students. The freshmen and parents I spoke to on move-in day knew about last fall, but they seemed pretty relaxed about it. I spoke to Jennifer Davidson of Rochester and her freshman daughter, Chloe. Here's what Davidson told me.
If you want to go to a Big Ten school or a big university, it's going to most likely be in a big city, and big city comes with its own elements of challenges, I guess you would say, of crime and, you know, safety measures. We've taught her well, so she's going to have to take those and use them on her own, be smart.
Other parents and freshmen told me the U has done a good job of informing them of the situation, you know, answering all their questions and giving them plenty of tips on how to stay safe. So they sound pretty ready for this fall.
All right. Thanks, Alex.
You're welcome.
All that eating and drinking we do at the Minnesota State Fair generates lots of trash. Last year, it was roughly 1.3 million pounds. This year, the fair's trash supervisors are trying to figure out how to make the fair a zero-waste event. Elizabeth Dunbar reports.
Do you have the footlong ones?
After you're done with this.
Chocolate, strawberry, and vanilla all mixed together.
Behind the scenes, there's a lot of this.
Nice shot!
Every day, a crew of more than 200 staff and volunteers clean up the fairgrounds. Fairgoers pitch their cans and bottles into 450 different recycling bins. Nearly everything else, cups, utensils, the leftover fried whatever on a stick, ends up in more than 1,100 trash bins. That trash, 650 tons of it last year, goes off to a burner. Sanitation supervisor Corey Franzmeier says with all the food waste generated at the fair, there's a lot of potential for more composting. These days, commercial composters can take everything from meat to dirty napkins and turn it into a rich mixture used for farming and landscaping. Franzmeier says the fair is off to a good start with 41 tons of waste sent to a composter last year.
Our composting program all started with the corn cobs.
There are several recycle your corn cob bins next to the corn roast. And back behind the grandstand track, several dumpsters are dedicated to food waste.
Year after year, we try to grow a little more. So as you can see, we have lemon peels. We do lemon peels and we do potato peels.
There's also some paper waste like napkins and serving boats. Franzmeier says this year his staff will do a trash audit to see how much of what's in the trash cans could be compostable.
We're trying to do the best we can to get to that point of being a zero waste event or, you know, close to it. So we're going to learn a lot about where we're at after this fair. I mean, it could very well be possible that that garbage bag will be compostable and everything in it could be compostable.
Franzmeier predicts cups will be the item that holds things back. Most of them aren't compostable, and he says switching over to a type that is won't happen overnight with hundreds of fair vendors that set up shop for just 12 days.
I think everybody's trying to get to this direction, you know? It's not a perfect situation, but I think we do a pretty good job of getting everything where it should go.
One state fair exhibitor cheering on efforts for more recycling and composting is the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, which coordinates the fair's eco experience. MPCA spokeswoman Pam McCurdy.
You know, we look forward to see what they come up with. I think it's just going to get better and better.
The MPCA did its own statewide trash audit and found that both food waste and paper are ending up in landfills more than they should. So one of the main attractions at this year's Eco Experience is a world record-breaking ball of paper that represents how much paper Minnesotans throw away in 30 seconds.
With our last waste composition study, we said, wow, we're still throwing a billion pounds of paper a year. I mean, that's a lot of paper. A lot of paper that actually gets reused. So it's a resource, and it provides jobs all across the state.
McCurdy says the ball of paper and signage have turned lots of heads. That was true on a recent afternoon. Greg Kugler of Golden Valley, Bob Hupfer of Cambridge, and Julie Steinhagen of Chaska shared their thoughts.
We're wasteful.
Some of it's apathy, some of it's laziness.
Yeah, I'm always surprised because it's not that hard every 30 seconds. It's incredible.
Elizabeth Dunbar, Minnesota Public Radio News, Falcon Heights.
It's hard to escape the ice bucket challenge. People tape themselves dumping a bucket of ice water on their heads, then they post it to social media and challenge their friends to do the same thing or donate some money. Well, the challenge has sent donations to the ALS Association skyrocketing. Kathy Wizer talked with Jennifer Jelly, executive director of the local ALS Association chapter.
Clearly this has taken off. How does the money get divvied up between the National Association and the state chapters?
Well, there's a couple ways that happens. One, first of all, a lot of people, as you mentioned, are giving to our national organization, but we're seeing incredible increase of donations directly to our chapter. In fact, I just looked before we chatted that the number of donations that have just come in our general lines has increased dramatically. So in the month of July, we received maybe about 10 to 15. We don't get many donations just online outside of events. So far this month, we've had over 1,400. So as you can imagine, our small staff is going through these as quickly as possible, and that doesn't even include what's coming in the mail. As we look at what's coming into our national office, we have a group of us that are working on how we best use this likely one-time influx of funds to help accelerate our current mission priorities, so research, care services, and advocacy.
Okay, so now the local chapter, I understand that you have things for folks living with ALS. You have a bank of medical equipment that if someone needs a lift or a wheelchair, they can contact you. Is that money spent there too as well as research?
Well, first and foremost, if a donor designates that they want their dollars to go to research, that's where it's going to go. So that's first priority number one. And I want donors to know that they can do that and they can say what they want their particular donation to go towards. The dollars that come in that are general here locally, we'll look at a couple of things. We'll look at the loan pool that you mentioned, we'll look at what we have a waiting list for, and that waiting list fluctuates from day to day. But if we have a number of people that are waiting for a specific piece of equipment, we may take this opportunity to shorten that list and purchase some more items. We'll also look at our communication and assistive device program for people that are waiting for communication devices, and can we shorten those lists? And absolutely, we're going to look at how we as a chapter can give more to our national research program and accelerate the process for treatments and a cure.
I know you're talking to the national organization, and when the former head was here in town recently, I talked with her about fundraising long before the Ice Bucket Challenge, and she mentioned that the national group was spending more money on research into effective treatments and certainly a potential cure. So is there any feel as to how this huge influx of donations will change how many more research grants can be doled out?
Well, I don't have a number. I think what we're going to look at is what projects have we wanted to fund that we just haven't been able to. And those really range in their price tags from, you know, on the low end, a few hundred thousand dollars to up to the upper millions.
Final question here. What do you make of the criticism of the effort? Some folks are just calling this a stunt. Some people are, you know, a little not happy about the what they call coercion, someone dumping water in their head and then challenging their friends to do the same. What about that?
Well, you know, I think with any big success like this, those types of comments will come in. But what I would say is it's working. And the spotlight that it has brought to a community that often doesn't get the spotlight is amazing. And the hope that it is bringing to people living with ALS and their families, you can't put a price tag on that.
All right. Jennifer Jelly, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That conversation on Morning Edition. Time for another installment of Minnesota Sounds and Voices. Kathy Werzer introduces it for us.
Did you know that Minnesota has a gem-like collection of wild places called scientific and natural areas? One of them is the Lost 40 in northern Minnesota. It preserves a remnant of the state's ancient forest. Amber Beth Vanagon is a forest ecologist with the Department of Natural Resources.
When the logging came through, these trees were left, and so they were lost to time.
One version of why the huge trees were spared the axe is that the surveyors mapped the area as a wetland. Minnesota Sounds and Voices reporter Dan Olson takes us for a stroll through the Pine Cathedral.
A very nice bug-clearing breeze riffles aspen leaves high above the Lost 40 forest floor. It's ground level, where mosquitoes wait to welcome warm-blooded visitors. A dose of bug spray helps. Then DNR forest ecologist Amber Beth Vanagon ventures into the quiet of a rare remnant old-growth forest that includes the state's largest red pine.
For all we know, there's an even larger red pine out there somewhere. We just haven't discovered it yet.
The biggest trees are about 130 feet tall, perhaps 300 years old. Yes, toddlers compared to sequoia and redwood, but plenty large compared to trees in nearby logged forests. The biggest have trunks that need two or even three people holding hands to surround them. They include valuable white pine, cherished by woodworkers.
They grow nice and straight. The wood is nice and strong. They grow tall, as you can see, looking up to this tree. And they're also quite beautiful.
The Lost 40 is in north-central Minnesota's Itasca County. Nearby place names, Wirt and Aldwood, are little more than highway intersections. Canada is 50 miles north as the crow flies. The Lost 40 is one of 160 scientific and natural areas, or SNAs, in Minnesota. These tracts of land exist to protect habitat and geographic features. Delicate Indian pipe colonies poke out of the forest floor here and there. The plant isn't especially rare, but it looks unnatural. Ghost white, surrounded by green plants and the brown forest floor. The plant has no chlorophyll, and it's fragile.
If you were to touch it, it's very wet and almost would dissolve in your hands.
The Lost 40's geology includes an 11,000-year-old Ice Age relic.
An esker left by the glaciers, so kind of a nice glacial, gravelly deposit.
Van Ningen says people won't see many eskers outside SNAs because they've been mined for gravel. Moose Brook slices through a part of the Lost 40. It drains a willow and alder marsh on one side and black spruce and tamarack bog on another. Minnesota's scientific and natural areas have a relatively small but devoted following. Retired college math professor Carol Owlsgard was born and raised near the Lost 40 and now lives in New Jersey.
I come every year to check the progress of the little white pine that are growing up and the deer aren't eating.
Hunters are allowed on the Lost 40 to help slow deer predation of the young white pine. Otherwise, human activity on SNAs is limited. Hiking, snowshoeing, skiing, photography, and bird watching are allowed. Camping, picnics, and motorized vehicles are banned. Amber Beth Vandingen says these natural areas protect islands of habitat diminished almost everywhere else by farming and logging. She says there's another bonus.
There is a value for people as well, just having a place to go and see this beautiful creation that we've been blessed with. It is beautiful. It's awe-inspiring, I think, no matter who you are.
Minnesota DNR forest ecologist Amber Beth Vandingen. The Minnesota Sounds and Voices pieces produced by our Dan Olson. And that's the NPR News Update for Wednesday. Phil Picardi bringing you the Minnesota News right back here Thursday.